Hi, this is Nobo Calypso. Ho'opaipai'okei'nalu. I want to engage your thinking today and let us think together of some processes that are going on throughout the world. Mostly I'm going to speak about some syndromes that are occurring in America and in Japan, not so much to make a comparison or a measurement, but for us to think a little bit outside the box and to think what actually is going on in our age today. But first, I want to tell you that there's a quote that's relates to what we're going to be discussing tonight. And this is a quote that comes out of Shakespeare from King Lear. And the quote is, "When we are born, we cry to come forth." And that quote has always gotten to me in heart. Not only from a metaphysical study, but from just by arriving on the planet. And to think today, when we are born, we cry to come forth. What circumstances do we as photons, as light beings, what circumstances do we come upon on the planet that immediately brings tears to our eyes as we start slowly dissolving inside of ourselves due to the consciousness that exists? Because certainly before we come to the planet, I imagine that our ideals and what we think we're going to do and what we are going to do are two different things entirely. And we tend to forget all of the stark realities that exist on this mundane plane. Now, I suppose that I'm speaking from a place of presumption, saying that, okay, I'm having this discussion based on incarnation or reincarnation, but I'm going to tell you what backs this up for me. And many people I know who do remember their childhoods would probably nod with me in agreement. But I remember, I'm going on 55 years old. It's almost like the same thing that I'm saying, that regardless if there's a glitch in software or a computer, it's still within the same experience. I'm still experiencing within this moment what I experienced before the radio station had a small glitch. And that's how I see the time travel from the age of, you know, being a newborn to being a 55-year-old adult, is that simultaneously I don't see much difference, even though I know that my the body, the organic body I'm in, has gone to, you know, undergone some drastic changes. Drastic only within my eyes, but drastic not within the pure cycles of living. When I was a child and I came upon the planet, I remember that there was a sensation, a feeling of of what I would accomplish upon the planet. And I know that I was very optimistic. I also know that I brought with me a longing, almost like not a separation longing, but a quick longing to return, almost like I decided that, well, maybe this isn't really what I want to do, but still feeling a drive that, okay, I will accomplish this. And I really didn't see time stretched out before me. In fact, I didn't see a thing called time. I didn't see cycles or years or calendars or anything like that. I had maintained a sense of purpose. I maintained a sense of mission. But it was a sense of mission in the most joyful sense of accomplishing a mission. And I didn't feel weighed down by the limitations in time. So I also recall that there's a lot of inspiration around me, and I'm not talking about my organic family, you know, the biological family or the psychological family. It was inspiration that was commonplace to me, that was very familiar. And this, without this inspiration, and without my becoming a master mystical numerology, I wouldn't be 55 years old today. I would have checked in a long time ago. But it was within the inspiration of the familiar energies that were around me that uplifted me and applauded me with great optimism to complete this path. And then as you get older, there you get more and more discouraged, because I feel that the human body is exactly like the root system of a tree. I don't think that there's much difference at all. In fact, I don't see much difference between us and a tree anyway. But the nervous system acted much like the root system in the tree. And so my nervous system went out like little antennas to pick up things in my environment. And it started taking in its toxic stuff within the environment that I lived in. I would consider that the nutrients within that environment were just very toxic, very poisonous nutrients, if you could consider them such things, that I brought into my nervous system, which went into my nervous system cells and kind of created imprints, and there was more imprints and more imprints. And basically, I had grown up as a pauper on the streets of Philadelphia, and they were going through a horrendous time of a war with blacks, you know, whites against blacks at that time, blacks against blacks. And there was the thing about the Russians and the thing about the Japanese and the things about this and that, that the adults would tell to we children and scare the daylights out of us, the Vietnam War and all this stuff was going on. And so all this started pouring in, and that started chiseling away at my mission. And I started getting further and further away from it, because there certainly wasn't any inspiration from the organic beings that were around me, because they were more robotic. They didn't seem familiar to me. And so I started to detach from them. And so the mission became chiseled more and more and more away, and just to survive within this poisonous environment seemed to be one of the main things I had to do. So the mission got tucked away because I had to pay attention to my survival as a small child, you know, running away from this awful environment at 4 or 5 years old, because I had taken this in through my own nervous system. So years go by and years go by and years go by, and the mission gets chiseled away, and the nervous system cells start imprinting with more and more and more of this negative vibrational stuff happening with on this plane. And then the mission comes back, like, oh, remember me? It's like, yes, I do. And you see such a contrast, not so much a separation, but a contrast, almost like a dichotomy. Well, this is my mission, but this is a very toxic environment. How am I supposed to do this mission within this toxic environment? You know, I didn't feel as a child that I came here, you know, as a knight on a horse with a sword. And I certainly didn't come here prepared to go out and do battle just to live my mission. I felt that there would be a harmonious flow to this, and there certainly wasn't. So my feeling about incarnation is, it's not even debatable with me. I know that I was the person that I am today with inside of my heart at the time that I was born. It's just that it got pushed further and further and further into that marble casing. It became too crystallized, too solidified. But, and I knew that I came from someplace greater, or greater wasn't a word that I would use, but I came from a distant yet close place that surpassed the consciousness that I was in at that time, and I didn't quite understand because everything was supposed to be familiar to me. At least I thought it was. So, in saying that, what I'm saying is that I know that when I was a child, I didn't see myself as a child, but I saw myself as an entity, and I saw myself as an individual entity that was linked up through familiarity with other entities and other energies, and I knew this to be fact. I knew this as well as taking a breath, that I wasn't alone, and that everything around me had a connection to me somehow, through accords or what, everything was connected. You know, I couldn't describe it in quantum physics terms or thermodynamics, but I knew that I automatically knew there was a connection. And when the organic objects around me tried to disconnect or tried to prove to me there wasn't a connection, it was almost like shorting out. I didn't quite understand what they were talking about, so I would become very rebellious and angry. You know, don't sever my connection. Why are you doing this? Why are you placing yourself above and beyond me when we're the same? I don't quite understand this, and I also knew that there was this higher, more magnificent level that agreed with me and not them. And not saying that we are pitted against each other in the first place. So that being said is why I can talk to people from a place that I already assume that others would agree with reincarnation, because of our childhood experiences, that we know that we're already interconnected and we're not displaced until our parents tell us, don't talk to your father. He's a drunk and he's a son of a bitch. It's, you know, when people start disconnecting us is, well, this person got straight A's. Why do you have C's and D's? You know, well what does it matter? I excel in art. It's that separation, that measuring through, you know, people's perception and observation, and that enjoyed separating. And I didn't. But you had to go along with this and almost be like a little warrior to try to maintain that connection. So, that being said, there's some processes, some syndromes going on in America, and there's some syndromes going on in Japan. And it's syndromes where people are isolating themselves from society. Now, I've done this twice in my life for 5-year periods. One time I went up to the San Juan Islands for 5 years and just completely vanished. It's just, if anybody knows the San Juan Islands, the archipelago up below Victoria in Washington State, Orcas Island and San Juan Island, they're just incredibly beautiful places. And I had gone there and isolated myself for a 5-year period. Could have been a little over 5 years. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed being with me. I enjoyed going in for my self-discoveries because I was tired of the organic robots around me trying to disconnect me when I knew there wasn't a disconnect. So I just went there to not reestablish the connection, but enjoy the connection from my psycho-spiritual self, from my authentic self through nature. And that's where I groomed myself in mystical numerology, and that's where I groomed myself in Huna. And I taught myself these things because, let's be frank, I just didn't trust, you know, these organic robots that were trying to disconnect me all the time by measuring me with somebody else, by bringing forth their hubris, their arrogance, which really turns out to be extreme naivety. And it's really more sad than it makes a person more sad than it does angry. It's just really sad. So for 5 years I had done that. And I didn't feel guilty about it. I didn't feel shameful about it. I didn't feel as if it was a disorder. I didn't feel anxiety in the world in public places or you know, I still went out. I didn't feel a great anxiety. I just didn't feel like being around a lot of this energy, and it seemed as I was growing up, it was more and more and more in schools and colleges and workplaces. It was more and more and more. It just seemed as if everybody was kind of zapped by the same radar gun or the Christianity gun or whatever it was. Everybody just seemed so bamboozled to me. And I refused to capitulate. It's like that Jean Genet play, Rhinoceros. I didn't want to become a rhinoceros. But I didn't feel anxiety. I didn't feel panic. It's just a choice that I made. It was a choice of self-preservation. So I came out of the islands and I rejoined society or whatever Western terms would call that. You know, I go forth in society and become a outstanding member, whatever that entails. You know, I have no idea, and nor do I really care. But I came back and I used my mystical numerology and I used my HUNA secretly because I didn't want anyone disconnecting that from me because they were trying to disconnect everything else. For instance, when I was a small child, I wanted to write. And I knew that I was supposed to, this is one of the things that I would do is use communication through writing. And since I was a boy, well, this was just the most grotesque thing that they had ever seen. And books were taken from me, and anything that I wrote was destroyed. And that's one of those things to try and disconnect me. And to this day, it doesn't make sense. You know, that simultaneous part of me doesn't justify what those goofy people did. Because all I would do is go out and just start hiding this stuff in places that I knew that they couldn't find it, like outside the house. But I didn't understand why they were trying to disconnect me from something that was so beautiful. But they did. And so I wouldn't share the mystical numerology, the HUNA, with anyone because I didn't want that naive hubris to try to disconnect me. So I applied it in all the work that I did. And I worked in behavior health. I worked with developmentally disabled. I worked with teens in crisis. I worked with Alzheimer's. I worked in the hospitality industry. I began a nonprofit organization for metasexuals, and I used my abilities within that, but secretly. And then it came a time when I was tired of the veil, what I saw as the veil, is this energy within the veil, that things were getting really thick. You know, and you could feel this. You could just feel this thickness. And you couldn't cut it, not with an elephant tusk, not with a ram's horn. You couldn't cut this. It was so thick, and it wasn't so much individual, but it was like a herdish movement of this fast moving fear type thing of gathering is what it felt like. There was so much fear, like a stampede, but a stampede to gather more. And not only to gather more, but to judge those who weren't gathering as quickly. And in my simultaneous self, it just felt incredibly alien. Like, I don't want to be swept up in this current. I had a beat up Volkswagen Bug, for God's sakes, and I loved it. And I loved that car. It was a part of me. I was part of the car, but you get confronted with this stuff, the stratification stuff of, why are you wearing flip-flops and jeans and tie-dyed shirts? It's like, well, what business is it of yours? So I felt this energy, this pervasive, invasive energy of this stampede, these herds running so fast to gather and gather and accumulate. And I did not want to be caught up in this. And it was the fear that alarmed me the most because people weren't doing, the energy wasn't moving joyfully. It was moving with a fear-based notion. You know, and they were, it was carrying guilt and shame and all this stuff along with it. And I didn't want any parts of it. So I vanished again for another 5 years. And it wasn't from a panic. It wasn't from a disorder. It wasn't, you know, I didn't even think about that. It's like, well, I just don't want to be around this invasive energy all the time because I don't want to become a rhinoceros. I don't want to capitulate to this. And again, it was a choice. And again, I went into very deep studies. I increased my work even greater. I studied so much, thousands and thousands of books. I wrote manuscripts after manuscripts after manuscripts. I practiced. And then I came out again. And I now it's more of a sometimes I go out, sometimes I stay in, sometimes I go out, sometimes I stay in. And there may be another period where I might vanish for another 5 years. I don't know. And it doesn't, it's not a concern of mine. But it seems to be a concern, a diagnosis within Western society. And it's kind of surprising to me because in Western society, if there's something that's abnormal, and I really don't know what is normal and what is abnormal to begin with, but what is abnormal has to immediately be treated, has to be diagnosed 9 times out of 10 from the DSM 4 or 5, whatever that creepy manual's up to, but that's a diagnostical statistic manual of mental disorders. It's the one that the insurance company wants slapped on all physicians' desks, and they demand the diagnosis. So, I guess it becomes an uncommon thing that somebody wants to separate from the herds, and to me, bards used to do it all the time. You know, poets would do it, writers would do it, bards would do it, and it's something that had to be done. If you want to realize who you really are as an individual, if you want to differentiate who you are as an individual, get the heck away from the masses. You know, don't capitulate. And it made perfect sense to me. And it still does to this day. But now I'm seeing that it's known as it's a disorder. And I never thought about it as a disorder then. I never thought that something, you know, a simultaneous side of myself would ever need to be medicated. So that I could be pushed out of my little comfortable cave, like pushed back into the masses. And to be frank with you, if anybody attempted such a thing, they would deal with a force greater than a volcano because I didn't want to. And I believed in my free will. And I'm a very strong-willed individual, especially when I don't want to capitulate. Which I think that we all should be. So to differentiate oneself, I believe one has to separate from the masses, and I don't know why this is considered a disorder. In Japan, it's considered hikikomori, and that's called, it's considered an adjustment disorder. And that's as far as they go to label it. And it's more or less like a syndrome. And hikikomori in Japan are individuals, usually males, between the ages of, 17, and it can go up to late 30s. It's men who have decided that they're not going to deal with the rigid, inflexible, bureaucratic ways of their society, and they retreat into their rooms. And when you say retreat into the rooms, they retreat into the rooms. Not the house, but the room. And they become isolated from all contact with people, including their mothers and fathers. They could live in this room up to 3-4 years, and the mother or father hasn't seen them. They just, you know, slide food in front of the door, and the hikikomori stays in there. And it's a time, I think, to reconnect with the psycho-spiritual self, but there is so much governing that from the society around them. There's it's encased them in almost a bubble of fear, because it's almost a shameful thing to do, but it's still something to be done that's absolutely necessary. And I think a lot of the time is spent going through the different avenues of the nervous system to decide, you know, is this is this a shameful thing to do? Is this the right thing to do? I can't go back outside, yada, yada, yada. And it's day after day after day after day after day of this pondering, which I suppose can lead into anxiety. But the hikikomori do want to come out into society. They just don't know how. And to me, it's a silent revolution, because Japan's not known for protesters. They haven't gone through, Japanese haven't gone through this big protesting thing like America does. You know, America, when things are out of order, we're going to protest, like with women's rights. We got out there and protested. You know, the Vietnam War, the humpback whales, you know, with the impeach a president. You know, we're just going to get out there on the streets and start screaming and howling our heads off. And we're going to be joined by other people. And it's the same in Europe. Japanese don't do this, so they're, because it's a very homogenous society that's governed within a core. There's a nucleus that governs all this, and the nucleus is inflexible and will not change. And that's why the hikikomori isolate themselves to get away from this core. So they don't protest. But it is a silent revolution, and by them, by one hikikomori staying within his room, he's protesting. And to me, I see it as a silent protestation to say, I am an individual and I want to know who my individual self is. But because he's Japanese and it's in his DNA that, no, you know, it's rude and inappropriate to, and it's in fact outlandish to think that you're an individual and you stand apart from other people. And you can't really stand apart because everything's interconnected. So that's like a myth. You really can't stand apart. And if you look at nature, nature doesn't make two things identical. So, but there's a sameness. So just by the hikikomori living in Japan, he's already connected. And even if the hikikomori moved to New York, he's still connected by the roots, by the ancestors, by the DNA, by the cells, and by the atoms. There can never be a disconnect, and thermodynamics says that there, you just can't disconnect. Once things have come together, they just don't disconnect. They could become something else, but they're still connected, and quantum mechanics proves that as well. So, in Japan, there's the hikikomori, and then in America, we have the agoraphobics, and usually these are women. In Japan, there's about 3 million hikikomori, and interesting, in America, there's about 3 million female agoraphobics. Now, they have to deal with Western medicine, because Western medicine, what the Western world says, oh no, this can't be. We can't have these people, these women hiding away inside their houses, because that's not of the norm of our society. They've got to be brought out. And so there's almost like an aggressive type therapy to bring these people out. And also, you know, of course, the DSM slapped in there. And, you know, if you have some silly psychiatrist, there's going to be some medications, you know, just turn them into a zombie and push them out the door and lock the door. I'm not saying that's what they do. The thing about the agoraphobics is fear of public and these open spaces. And it's a panic. It's a panic disorder. And they feel anxiety within these crowds, and they hurry back to the confines of their house. Now, the agoraphobics, when they live in the homes, they usually live what can be considered a normal life, whatever the heck that is. But a lot of them don't isolate themselves to one room, but they take care of their families, they take care of the home, they talk to people on the telephone, they have friends come over, they have family come over, they go out to their yard. You know, there's things that they do. So they're not as the hikikomori, because the hikikomori won't set foot out of that bedroom. you know, just to think that a neighbor will spot him and start chattering. I mean, it reminds me of, you know, Christians who enjoy sticking their nose over other people's backyards just so you don't piss off their God. Well, that's in their imagination anyway. So who gives two blind toads about that? So the agoraphobics, the females, you know, they could be married. They could be living with a boyfriend, or they could be living with friends, or they could be living with their family, or, you know, roommates or things like that. And they exist. Their existence takes place within the home, not within society, because of the panic that they feel. Now, when you really look at this, and you think about when we were born, and you think about Shakespeare's, and I'm not asking you to, you know, just turn around and say, oh yeah, well, that's what Nobo says, so that has to be right. What I'm doing is asking yourself to expand, go beyond the Western diagnosis of agoraphobics, and just think of a young woman who wants to seclude herself in the house and doesn't want to come out into the world because it creates anxiety. Let's look at that. Let's not look at the diagnosis that was given to her, and let's look at the hikikomori that do not want to, or let's look at the young men in Japan who do not want to come out in society. They're just not ready. So when you think about what Shakespeare said, when we are born, we cry to come forth. And then it goes on, you know, we cry to come forth to be amongst fools or something like that, be amongst a lot of fools. Or because there's that sudden realization, or with me, it took a little while to get it, that now there's something wrong going on with these organic robots around here. I mean, there is definitely something wrong. And even if I go into the next yard or the next pasture or the next district or the next city, there is definitely something wrong with these organic robots. It's almost like it seems everybody has been hypnotized or mesmerized to gather, to consume, to have stratification, to just not live from heart, but to live from thumbs. And then just by living with thumbs, they just think that they're greater than anything else that exists within the universe, because they have, oh, for God's sakes, they got thumbs. And if you think of the qualities of a child, and if you can remember, you know, being innocent and filled with optimism, but then things are being said to you as you get older. I don't want you walking down that street alone because someone could kidnap you. And that's just against everything that we as children know. Or don't talk to that person next door because he's black. Well, he didn't look black to me. You know, he's the color of like an almond. Well, no, he's black. You can't talk to him. So what does black mean? Black means you don't go there. Oh. And these other things. Don't listen to your father because he's crazy. Don't listen to your mother because she pops too many pills. What does that mean? What are these pills? And these things start grating on you more and more and more. You're sitting in the classroom and you got this crazy screaming headache, and a teacher has you stand up in the middle of the classroom to recite something. You know, did you memorize that? No, I didn't memorize that. Why not? Because it didn't make sense. Why do I want that inside my head? I don't want to memorize that. I don't want that inside of me. No, of course I didn't memorize it. It didn't make sense, any sense at all. But I did memorize this. No, we didn't ask you to memorize this. We asked you to memorize that. So all this starts happening. Well, you know that you got these grades and you can't go on to the next level. I wasn't aware that I was here to transform onto next levels. You know, I'm obligating myself to go through this silly little structure of yours, you know, to, you know, every day wake up and go into this classroom with all these screaming kids and you saying these ridiculous, silly things from this book that don't even make sense. you know, this whole thing about Columbus is just a bunch of pooey. And if you tell me about the amoeba one more time in 10th grade, after I heard about it in 2nd grade, I'm just going to implode. So when you think about the effect of this day after day after day after day after day, there's only so much our nervous system can take. And I consider myself a very strong person, and there's just times that, oh, no, there is just no way I'm going to go out and listen to this malarkey for another moment. So I retreat. I retreat to what I know is safe, and that's inside of myself. It's the safest place I know to be. It's not necessarily in a house, because I realize that blue ice could come screaming through the roof, but it's I can retreat inside of me to find the safest, most beautiful place that I've ever found. And I'm safe there, I'm content there, I'm happy there, and I have peace there. What difference does it make to somebody else when I come out of that place and I have to sit there and listen to the stuff that's always separating? And it exists within our language, with the nouns, everything in the English language separates us from the subject and the noun. Everything is separated. And the largest word that's used in the English language is I. And you get so tired of using that word, and you get so tired of hearing it. Well, I. It's when you work with the Hawaiian language, it doesn't exist. When you work with the Japanese language, it doesn't exist. Because everything is brought in, especially in the Hawaiian language, everything is like a big ohana. Everything is brought in together into one being and interconnectedness. The book will bring good study instead of, I want that book. And it drains you after a while. It's like, how many times a day have I said the word I? And how many times a day has these people I work with had said the word I? And it just gets exhausting. And so I don't see it as being terribly awful that people retreat for a little bit. So the thing about it is that if people want to come out into the world, I think that we should reach out to them. Instead of turning our nose up to what's considered a disorder, we have to really give these people respect and honor their choices and their decisions. And I think that the greatest thing that we could do is reach out with love and with compassion, with understanding, and congratulate them for their ability to go inside to differentiate themselves as an individual outside of the masses. To label them and put them in a pillory, to label them and put them in the middle of a square and throw tomatoes at them, I just think it's a terrible thing to do. I mean, luckily, when I decided to retreat, I'm not the type of person that would turn around and I don't listen to other people's opinions of what I should do and what I shouldn't do. I listen to the inspiration that comes from inside. It's very rare that I'll listen to an outside opinion. I may weigh it, but I'm not going to suddenly, oh, I have a disorder. I'm agoraphobic. Oh, I see. It's I have a panic disorder. Oh, I see. Oh, a lot of anxiety. Oh, I see. Oh, and I should take what? Zoloft. Oh, I see. Okay. Okay, fine. You know, you want to be aggressive with my third? Oh, well, that's okay too. Yeah, that's fine. I would never agree to such a thing. But I think that in our interconnectedness, we need to be aware that we do have 3 million brothers and sisters in this country, mostly sisters, that do have a syndrome or a process where what is going on in public places really frightens these people. And I think that maybe we should decide, well, when I'm out in public, maybe I should think about walking the earth a little lighter. Maybe I should think about my part in what I do in society as have an effect on my brothers and sisters. Maybe I shouldn't be rude. Maybe I shouldn't be considerate. Maybe I should be a little bit more thoughtful. Maybe I should take the time to talk to a person and really listen. Maybe I should wear more of a smile on my face than a scowl. Maybe I shouldn't run down the street banging into everybody because I have to hurry up and get to work. Maybe I shouldn't scowl at a cashier. Maybe I should remember that others are just as frail as I am, and we're living in very sensitive times. So maybe it's a good idea to think about being a little bit more benevolent and a little bit more compassionate. Maybe it's a good idea to start walking a little bit more lightly on the earth. Maybe it's a good idea not to be thundering past other people that are doing this foot race to gain whatever it is that we're supposed to gain, because nature's always changing, there's always movement, and there is no end. So what the heck are we all racing towards? Even if there's the end of the world, it's not the end of energy, it's not the end of spirit, there is no end. So what are we racing towards? Maybe we ought to take that time to acknowledge one another and not paying attention to this Western malarkey that everything has to be depersonalized, objectified. There has to be rigid pragmatism. We don't have to pay attention to this boo-hooky about only the strongest and the fittest survive. You know, we should throw off these jokes of these ridiculous things that people are always saying and not repeat them to another person. Because it doesn't ring true within our hearts, so why on earth would we say that to another person? Maybe when we see someone who's sensitive, we don't come off with such a line of, oh, you wear your heart on your sleeve. Or the meek will inherit the earth. Don't worry, honey. You know, and maybe we should think not to take advantage of people who are more vulnerable and fragile than us. Maybe if each one of us here and in Japan decided to rechannel a little bit more with our heart, because what it is, it's a major heart crisis happening on the whole planet. And the hikikomori and the agoraphobics are very much aware of this. Maybe if we express more tenderness, maybe if we allow ourselves to speak from our hearts, just maybe that person might want to come over to our house and visit. That person may see that as much as we feel safe with inside of ourselves, they can be safe with us. And maybe we should start feeling safe with inside of ourselves. Maybe we should start really looking deep and seeing what our energy is and who we really are. Maybe we should start paying attention to the beautiful, pure energy that's pouring around us and stop paying attention to the things that are conditioning us. Maybe we should all start shirking that. Maybe we should all take responsibility for our scales, for our inconsiderations, for our thoughtlessness, for our rudeness. And today, during this economic crisis, you would think that Americans would pull together greater and have greater inclusion and turn to their neighbors. But no, they're drawing lines down. I am protecting my home. Get away from me. I have a bazooka. I'm taking care of my own. I'm keeping my plasma TV and both my cars in the garage. And I don't care what it takes. I'm keeping it. Well, isn't that a legacy to leave behind? So maybe we ought to go beyond this. Maybe we really need to touch into nature and into the nature of our beings and know that we have to take responsibilities for our actions and for us thundering on the earth, that maybe this causes, or maybe it doesn't cause, but maybe this helps add to an agoraphobic going into their home and not coming out to share their wonderful gifts and talents. Or a hikikomori, shutting the door and sealing it, you know, pasting papers all over the windows. Maybe in their silent revolution, we can join them in saying, yes, we are individuals. Yes, that's why the Big Bang happened, so we can all come forth for the expression of our individuality that is still interconnected to the whole. No, we won't compartmentalize our thinking. No, we won't always live in our head. Because the brain could die, but the heart keeps beating. The heart stops beating, and that's it on the brain. That's it on the organic body. So what is the most important organ in the body? And what is the most important essence to share with one another? Don't you think it's heart? I do. So get to know your vibrations. Get to know who you are as an individual. Differentiate. But in that time, let's try to walk more lightly on the planet. Let's not just say, oh, well, she's an agoraphobic, that's her problem, or he's hikikomori, oh, well, you know, I'm afraid of him, he might beat me up. Let's open the compassion from our hearts and honor and respect their decision. And walk more lightly on the earth. And walk with greater joy for the life that we do have. Yeah, there's suffering on the planet. You know, I'm just about taxed to the limit of what's happening with the whales and the dolphins and the seal pups. I mean, I'm just ready to go ballistic on these people. I'm just ready to haul out cannons. You know, I'm just like beyond my capability of understanding, especially when all this is revolved around greed. You know, the most precious, the most beautiful creatures that we could share life with are just being slaughtered. You know, well, who are these people to take that enjoyment away from me, and who are they to take that away from the living organism and away from the universe, and to take that way down of nature? It's naively arrogant, and it's naively greedy. But instead of pulling out a great big bazooka, I try to give as much understanding as I possibly can. You know, I won't go someplace with a big hammer and clunk these people over the head and let, you know, or stick a harpoon in their backsides, let them know how it feels. But I try to give some understanding towards their naivety. Why are they so naive? You know, it's probably because their heart's closed. And because their heart's closed and they're working with their thumbs and their brain, you know, all they need is a little brain with a thumb on each side to run around on the planet to get everything done. But so I try to give understanding. I try to walk a little bit more lightly. I try not to let these people who already have vast insecurities with inside themselves, because it takes a very, very insecure, self-loathing entity to slice open a living baby seal pup. I mean, it doesn't take an altruistic, honest, beautiful being to do such a thing. It takes an entity filled with darkness and self-loathing. And you have to wonder, where does this come from? So, and a lot of these fishermen and whalers are just diehard, you know, they drink. So I try to give understanding, and I try to give hope that maybe, hopefully they'll find their way. Maybe somebody can float another flow around the world like Perry did. We need flow back floating around the world. We need flows floating in every city. We need that humpback blimp floating because it made a big, big impact. And over 35 years of trying to help these whales, it's, you know, we get manipulated again by the Whaling Commission. And that's not right. That's not walking lightly on the earth. And that's why hikikomoris hide. That's why agoraphobics can't come into public places. I mean, this is manipulation and exploitation, and it is energy felt within our Celtic web. It's within the network of who we are. And we all really need to pay attention to this. And Christians need to stop justifying their good and their evil deeds by saying Jesus Christ okayed this. Well, isn't that a bunch of boo-hoo? You know, we all just need to come through the heart. We have to learn to know your heart and open up your heart and walk more lightly on this earth. Slow down. And if anything has shown us within the last couple of years with the economy, it's like, slow down, slow down, slow down. And we're having to slow down, but we're slowing down to sit around in fear, anxiety, sin, guilt, whatever. It's like, slow down, walk lightly on the earth, talk to each other through heart. So take it a little bit further. Why are there agoraphobics in America, and why are there hikikomoris in Japan? if they are closing the doors from society, that becomes a part of us as well. They've closed themselves off from us. Why? And what can I do as a compassionate, benevolent, intelligent, vulnerable being do to help? And I think the best thing, I think, you may come up with a different solution, but I think the best thing to do is to have respect and honor their decision and let them know that you're walking lightly on the earth for their benefit and for your own benefit so that things could be more safe. And it's going to take us doing that. But if we continue going back to our old patterns of competing for stratification and having this individual strife to keep our possessions where they are in place, because, I mean, let's face it, they're not going to last forever, especially the way that corporations are, you know, making them today. They only make them to last so long. I think after this couple of years, people are going to start losing those plasma TVs and computers anyway, so it's, you know, it really seems to be a waste of time. Let's lend somebody else a smile. Even if we're bothered by those long lines, even if we're bothered by people chattering in front of us, let's try to be more patient. Let's slow down and be more patient with each other. And take the thought further. Why are people closing themselves off from the rest of the world? Why can't people find who they really are with each other? You can't. You know, you can't reconcile within this energy of the masses. It's absolutely impossible because it's all an illusion and a bold-faced lie. You know, it's who wants to capitulate to that madness? When we're born, we cry to come forth. So let's think about that. Let's not think about disorders, but let's think about the people who isolate themselves that. When we are born, we cry to come forth, and maybe we can lend them that compassion. And get to know who you are. This is a wonderful time to know who am I? Who am I differentiated as an individual? Who am I? How can I stay within my mission? How can I bring forth the greatest of my energies that will match with the higher octaves? Instead of grumbling and mumbling about what other people are doing. You know, it's happened. And as the economy collapsed, that just shows that there is an interconnectedness. What these higher echelon people did to get more money went clear down the ranks. Because everything is interconnected. And if that doesn't open up our eyes that everything is interconnected, nothing will. But we could change it. We could go to the opposite pole of this. We don't have to sit around and grumble and mumble and have fear with this. What we could turn around is have understanding. Well, that poor, naive person, the only thing that I could do is send him more, you know, greater thoughts to have greater understanding to say, you know, you're really naive in this approach, and I hope that you open up your heart greater so that we can all live with a little bit more harmony than what's existing at this time now. Let's look at each one of us, of our little concertos and our little symphonies and our little songs that all join together in the greatest concertos and the symphonies and songs of the universe. Let's play our music together through harmony, and let's harmonize with the ones that have isolated themselves. And let's look upon them as brothers and sisters with tenderness and compassion, and send them good energy. Let's make it a safer place. So take this forward and expand upon it. You know, don't get sucked into that Western bamboozling like, oh, this is such a terrible thing. We have a DSM that says this, and that. You know, and we're going to aggressively attack this disorder, this disease, like Western Newtonian science does. You know, we're just going to plow through this because what a terrible thing to exist. Oh, my God, it's a dis-ease. Well, poo with it. You know, as long as someone has accepted this choice and lives with it within the peace of heart, you know, the DSM has absolutely nothing I could do with its crackpot ideas. When I became reclusive, I did so with peace in my heart. And I just did not want to become a rhinoceros. If anybody's read the Jean Genet play Rhinoceros, you'll understand what I'm talking about. I did not want to capitulate. And it was a choice. And there wasn't a force there wasn't a force in the universe that could turn my mind to think something else. But, you know, people could have been kinder. Because the as unkind as people were, it just validated that, oh, this is a place I should be. So let's open up the hearts. Let's go through this heart crisis together and open up our hearts and reach out to one another. And this is a very large testing time. And I think pretty much a large percentage of Americans are failing this test. Let's reach out and have that inclusion. Once again, and I will leave you with a Hawaiian song. Oke aloha kaiyu, oke aloha kaiyu, oke aloha kaiyu, oke aloha kaiyu, and that means love is paradise. And do have yourself a good evening, and thank you for listening.